Hi, this is Max Cohn. We are the 26th of December 2008, and we are in Killingworth, Connecticut, in the United States. And I am with my cousin, Paul Kane, Paul W. Kane, who just published the book Sacred Violence, Torture, Terror, and Sovereignty. He is a professor of law and the humanities at Yale Law School. So tell me, Paul, what did you want to explain in this book?
Well, in the United States, we've been having a long debate the last few years over torture, and I thought the debate didn't really understand what was at stake. People didn't really understand why the country was so concerned about this or how to explain it. So I thought somebody needed to try and come to grips with why and how torture figures in the political imagination and the way it does. So the question I posed when I began the book is, if we're willing to kill, why not torture? What's the difference between torture and killing? And then the book approaches this from a philosophical point of view. It asks two questions. How did torture come to occupy the space it does in the imagination? And how does it figure in politics? And it's a systematic inquiry into both of those questions. I can tell you more if you'd like about it.
But is it related to the Bush period here in America?
Yes, it's related to the Bush period because the Bush administration got us back into the thinking about torture. It's not a book about the Bush policies about torture. It's a book about the conversation in this country about torture. In particular, it's a book about the place of what we call the ticking time bomb example, which is the explanation, the theory, the rationale that everybody uses to think about torture. So the question there is, if you capture someone who you think has information about a ticking time bomb, would you be willing to torture that person to find out where the bomb is in order to save a lot of innocent lives? And my view is that scenario is the exact equivalent in the modern age, contemporary period, of the nuclear threat in the Cold War. So we've gone from mutual assured destruction in response to the Soviet threat, to torture in response to the terrorist threat, which we represent as the ticking time bomb, and of course the time bomb is always the nuclear bomb. So we are recreating the foundations of the myth of the state in a new example, the ticking time bomb, and we're asking ourselves, what are we willing to do to save the state? And the answer is the same as the answer that has always been given since the invention of the modern state in the 18th and 19th century. We're willing to do everything, everything and anything.
Do you make a difference between the torture here in the United States and somewhere else in Europe, for example? The use of it, I mean.
Well, when we talk about torture, we have to distinguish two things. There's always a psychological pathology of torture. So there are people who are sadists and victimizers, and these are people who don't occupy my mind much. So if you make available a violent means, a violent possibility, there will always be people who seize upon it. Individuals, and you explain those individuals by their own particular psychological pathology. What I'm interested in is why an entire country, a community, starts thinking about torture as an acceptable, possible political practice. And that's where we were in the United States. Now, have the Europeans gone through this? I think they've probably gone through similar things at various times. I think Latin American countries were very involved in this. And in the book, I talk somewhat about the dirty wars in Argentina. And one of the very interesting things about political torturers, as opposed to these pathological torturers, is that they always think it's justified. And they always think it's justified because they think they're at war. And the example I always use, I believe every torturer who believes it's justified thinks about the ticking time bomb example in relationship to what I call the hand grenade example. They believe that they would jump on a hand grenade and sacrifice themselves. And it's that willingness to sacrifice that I argue creates the license to torture. That these are reciprocal phenomena. That individuals are willing to give up their own lives to absorb pain, and they think that willingness creates the possibility or the license to create pain in the other. So political violence, in my view, is always reciprocal. It's killing and being killed. Politics is a structure of violence, or the possibility of violence, in which each side offers itself as a sacrificial victim. And so part of the book is about trying to track and understand the nature of political violence.
So I've read all the books you've written, not everything, but because there are some complicated books. But could you wrote a book about King Lear, which is very interesting. Could you explain us what you wanted to tell in this book?
I tend to write books in pairs, and King Lear is the second of two books. So the book I wrote before that is a book called The Reign of Law, which is about the political imagination under the rule of law. In the United States in particular, but I believe in the West in general, particularly I believe it's true in France as well. When I was writing the book The Reign of Law, I was exploring the way in which a political community understands law, and I was very struck by the Jewish character, you might say, the Jewish tradition as it's been secularized. So we have revolution instead of revelation, but we understand law as the product of sovereignty and compliance with the law, as bringing oneself into contact with or performing that which is required by the community in its deepest values. It answers the question, not just when is law just, but it answers the question, why does law bind? How does it create a community and maintain a community through time? As I worked through that book, I became very much aware that there's another side of the idea of law, which we might call the Christian side, in which law is not the triumph, but law is the tragedy. So if men were could overcome their fallen condition, they wouldn't need law. They would have love instead of law. So I was looking for a vehicle to explore the relationship between law and love, in which law is not man's triumph, but a symbol of his fall. And then for other reasons, I was reading King Lear, and I realized that this book is all about the relationship between law and love, that this is a theme that other people I don't think have seen so clearly. It's probably because I'm a lawyer that I saw King Lear immediately as structured around a series of trials, and it's about what happens when political power tries to use the instruments of law to control love. Cordelia, how much do you love me? Right? And what we find is that the king goes mad, but law is beyond... love is beyond law, and that law is not adequate to the human soul. So the two books together are exploring the possibility of law as our highest accomplishment, as that which defines us as a community, and yet, in the second book, the failures of law, and how it's never adequate to a man's understanding of himself as infinite and realized in love.
But you wrote some other books, I think, no?
Oh, yes. I've explored these themes in a number of books. Most immediately, or most recently, before the book on torture, I wrote, again, a pair of books. One was attacking or trying to look at and criticize the foundations of liberal political thought, in which I argue that the foundation of the state is not contract, it's not the social contract, but rather it's the act of sacrifice. The state begins really with, think of the image of Isaac. It's the willingness to sacrifice the sons that creates and founds a political community. So it's that, that the state, I argue, is an erotic phenomena tied to violence, in which sacrifice is at the very core. This is a book called Putting Liberalism in Its Place. And the effort, and then that was followed by a book called Out of Eden, which is about evil. And the relationship between these books is, if you think about modern political theory, it understands the problem of politics to be to distinguish justice from injustice. And I argue that, in fact, we can't understand the political order just in terms of justice and injustice, but we have to have the terms love and evil as well. It's not just good and bad, it's love and evil. So you need a theory of love and you need a theory of evil to understand political experience, generally, but all experience, I believe. So these books are trying to develop a theory of love and a theory of evil, and Out of Eden is about the political forms of evil. And evil, and essentially, in my view, the problem is death. The problem is finitude. And there are two responses to the understanding that we will die. One response is to transcend death through love, eternal love, the infinite, transcendence. And the other is the flight from death, the turning away from death, the projecting of death onto the other, the murderous response, and that's evil. So these books are exploring the dimensions of love and evil, particularly in a political form.
Thank you very much, Paul.
You're welcome.